AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 40 for Thursday, January 28th, 2010. Two big ifs. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free. Try searching for AutoLine After Hours at the iTunes Store. Here we are Thursday night again for AutoLine After Hours. And as I start out every show saying, joining me as always, the extremist himself, Mr. Auto Extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
Good evening, John. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Peter.
Great.
And we'll come back to you in a minute because we got to get into your rants here. Also, as always, David Welch from Business Week. David, great having you here, too.
Good evening to you, John.
he tried to say authoritatively.
Glad to be here, as always.
We want David to do the whole show in his Scottish accent.
That'd be good. I'm not sure if he can maintain it.
So a wee bit Texan? Just a wee bit Texan it is. I'll give it a try.
If we goad him, then he'll do it. And we've also got somebody here that normally is monitoring the chat room. We've got Rumblestrip himself, Eric Trico. Eric, great having you here in the studio with us.
Great to be here, John. Thanks for having
me. So you're monitoring the chat, but by being in person, being live with us.
He's blown off the chat. He's done with the chat.
So, Peter, let's talk about
GM's new greeter?
GM's new greeter, door greeter.
That's how I refer to Big Ed. He's GM.
I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle as I go riding merrily along.
You know, GM's board took the path of least resistance to promote Ed, you know. And I know David's aware of this. The recruiters were having a horrible time getting quality people to even.
Why is that? Is that the salary cap problem?
A combination of the salary cap, you know, GM's current state of affairs, even though they have some great products, and they know they're not going to get Al Mulally money. Mm-hmm. So,
You will get the subset of people who can actually do this job. I mean, what I was told, Jeff Green and I did a story on this, and
there's like a half a dozen in the world.
I mean, there's probably, it's more than that, but if you want someone who actually has manufacturing or at least industrial or kind of consumer product experience, it's really tough to find. And, and here's an example, and I don't think he was.
Chris Mulally didn't have consumer product experience.
No, but he had industrial experience in manufacturing
with
labor and all of that. You know, the guy that I was sort of flogging in a couple of blog items just because I think, here's a guy who would be good is George Buckley of 3M. Consumer products, industrial, started at GM. Hmm. From what I've heard, he loves cars. Hmm. Now, 3M.
Never heard of him. What did he do at GM?
It was a long time ago, but he's done very good things at 3M. 3M's a good company.
3M's a great.
So I looked up his salary. The guy made $13 million last year. I mean, GM may be able to give a decent package of stock, but they're not going to pay $13 million. And, see, you had a guy at 3M. I mean, this isn't even like somebody from Microsoft or, Apple or something. I mean, this is. A good company, but and a large global one, but not a huge one, and he's made $13 million. So money is an issue. The turnaround is an issue.
But wait a minute, they got this guy Chris Liddell. I'm not sure how to say his last
name.
Liddell from Microsoft, and they're not paying him. I mean, they're not capped at $500,000 for him. They're paying him a million plus. They got him.
But one, he's the CFO, and he wasn't making massive money. Cashing out Microsoft stock and all that, he already made a lot of dough. And, the guy left Microsoft, and they had named another CFO, so he was looking for something else to do. And, also from what I hear, he was really a special case because he is charged up by the idea of this turnaround.
Yeah.
Not everybody has that kind of fire. So that's what I'm saying is you take the subset of people who have the right experience and can actually do the job, and then you cut away the ones who want the big money. Okay, and then you cut away the ones who, aren't charged up by a turnaround job. And then you got to find ones who are really are charged up to be the turnaround guy and to make history and, you know, believe in General Motors and American manufacturing and automobiles. You know, it gets smaller and small group gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And I think, I mean, what I was told basically is they figured they might be able to find the person and get him, but it's going to be quite a while. Could take a year. So you fire Rick in May, you fire Fritz in December. Then you got an interim CEO that everyone's working for a year, and they don't know, you know, if Whitaker's going to be there long and if that plan's going to stay in place. And then you get somebody new, you know, 6, 9, 12 months from now, another round of change. You know, this is where I see the board's perspective. Stability is a good thing.
Yeah, well, everyone's talking about stability, but they got to sell some freaking cars and trucks. And, you know, as long as Ed sticks to the how y'all doing and, you know, goes around the company and pats people on the back, that's great. As long as he stays out of Ed Welburn and Mark Royce's way. So, in other words, that's why I refer to him as the official company greeter. As long as he confines himself to that role, they'll be okay. But, you know, he isn't an inspired choice, I'll tell you.
Why not go for another car guy? You know, I keep saying Kravchuk, you know, and I don't want to flog a horse here. But
well, yeah, why not?
Like somebody with those skills would be perfect for
Kravchuk, from what we've seen, what I've seen in interviews not only with you but and read some other stuff, looks good. But then you have to worry, is he riding up sort of the what Toyota was a while ago, what Hyundai is now? They're sort of on that same trajectory where you look like a genius when you've got all that momentum carrying you.
Right.
Now, I don't think that's him,
right.
But...
I know a lot of people at Ford are kicking themselves that Ford let Kravchuk go. I mean, there are a lot of people at Ford thought this guy was going to go play.
Well, at least he has a clue.
Yeah.
And the thing with Kravchuk, though, is he has his good experience. He's done a good job, and I think he is quite good. But he's basically running a sales marketing organization that has input on product development, that doesn't develop products.
Right, but he spent his whole career at Ford in PD, in product development.
Yeah, but has he run an entire product development organization and product planning and a whole big company? I think if they were going to bring Kravchuk on, what you would do with John is he's the COO under, I was saying this when they were talking about it before, under Fritz, now he's gone. You know, maybe under Whitaker, who's the interim CEO, and let him sort of work his way into becoming the CEO. I mean, the COO job in America has suddenly become just way out of vogue and nobody does it. And in certain situations like this, I think it could work pretty well. But anyway, that's all fantasy. We're not going to get that because Big Ed is the CEO.
Right. But is he the right guy, Peter?
I don't think he's the right guy at all. But, I mean, if he stays out of the way, but if he starts taking a shining to giving input on products,
my fear is that, you know, here's a guy who did a great job at AT&T, took one of the little regional broken up Bells and turned it into this mega powerhouse.
Well, he's a deal maker.
Right. He's a deal maker. But what I'm saying is this guy never had instant access to the White House, never had the kind of media attention he's getting now. You know, we were there at the Brownstown battery plant where he comes in. Here's this entourage of media all around him, cameras and booms and lights. And he never went through that before. And I think it's...
He kind of like it.
It's good to be king.
Yeah. Well, that's bad.
That's my fear, is that he just feels like, hey, this is a fun job.
On the other hand, with all the regulation that is in the telecom industry and having to navigate the halls of Congress to pull off some of those deals, he might be a good semi-behind-the-scenes guy on just keeping all the idiots in Congress right now, just keeping them off his back or off the company's back so that the people who are really doing the work there can do the work.
I'll say one thing. I mean, you make a good point because, and I don't know how good the guys that he brought in to be the new lobby crew for General Motors are, but they got to be better than the people that they broomed out. I mean, Wagoner went to Washington. And, you know, I talked to Tony Cervone before this.
Who ran GM
PR. Who ran GM Public Relations back then. He's at United Airlines now, but this is the day before Wagoner went to Washington for the first go-around of the first flogging. And I said, you know, Tony, you guys are going to get just pilloried in Washington. He goes, oh, yeah, we know. And I'm watching this thing on TV, and I'm thinking, I thought you knew, Tony. But it wasn't his fault. It wasn't PR. The people in Washington really thought that they could just go there and say, you know, we're too big to fail, and, you know, it's an economic hit at a time when you don't need it, so give us some money. And no. And how many times did they have to go back with another plan? They never impressed Washington. They always thought right. they could do what they have done to the American consumer for years, which is give them the bare half-assed minimum and succeed. And Washington said, no, we're tired of that crap. Go away.
You know, everybody wants to blame the PR staffs for not having prepped them right.
I'm not blaming the PR staff. I'm blaming the government affairs staff in Washington.
Nah, I blame Rick Wagner and Bob Nardelli and even Alan Mulally. His performance was not good.
One of the other car companies who was working with the GM guys before the CEOs went there, and they said, yeah, they thought that they were going to just go in and say, hey, we need the money because too many jobs will be lost. Here's the economic impact. And nobody could tell these people that they had to do something. They had to go above and beyond and sell.
Even if you go in there, within 3 seconds, if you're good, you realize, oh, my God, we're in a totally different situation. And when somebody starts getting in my face, what they should have done was get right back in there.
No, that's what I said. They should have had Lutz there.
Back.
Yeah. Oh. They should have had Lutz there. At least the soundbite at the end would have been, the American.
They should have had was a plan for how they were going to pay back any money. They basically went before a loan officer and said, yeah, we might need more, and I don't know if we can pay back what you're going to give me because I really haven't run any numbers.
Yeah, well,
it's just stupid.
We should probably talk about.
Yeah, we have more to talk about, but. Go ahead, John.
We can talk about whatever we want here.
But but we've talked about those hearings.
We don't have to rehash the hearings.
But the point was that Ed's replaced those guys. And you're right, with the amount of regulation in telecom, people must know their way around.
Having worked at WorldCom back in the day, or WorldCon as it's affectionately referred to these days, and dealing with Bernie and deals together and all that is great, but.
Yeah, but John's on to something. Ed was. He got $160 million to go live his retirement in semi-obscurity. And all of a sudden, he's plucked into this thing, and he's sitting there. That's kind of cool, And, that's a thing to be afraid of. But as long as he stays out of Mark Royce and Ed Welborn's way, they'll be okay.
Give them the resources and let them rip.
Until they find the right person. Mm-hmm. But if he starts playing in that sandbox, they are in deep, deep trouble because there's no there with this guy.
Right.
I'm convinced. It's one thing to put deals together and, play your little Monopoly board on your desk. But, that's not what this business is about.
The problem is he's 68 years old, right? How long is he going to stay in that job? They talk about stability. He's not a car guy. He's someone who could stabilize the company now, but you're still looking at a couple of years from now, another change in the C-suite.
How old is Lutz? 77?
Yeah. But,
I know. He'll die in his office, I know.
Bob's a different case, but,
Well, we'll see how it goes. I'm totally with Peter. If he stays out of the car guy's hair, the basic part of what the car business is all about, if he stays out of that, things could be good because GM's got a pretty good team.
The one thing, though, does GM have to get away from having someone with a finance background as the chairman and CEO? I mean, if we look at the track record, other than, Ike. I can't think of his name now. He ran like the truck division. And he was CEO for all of about 18 months.
Stemple,
yeah. I mean, it's been finance guys for so long, and, the trajectory keeps going down. It's like, come on.
Well, they got rid of Stemple because he didn't have
any kind of finance.
He
had MBA and all that, I know. But
I think you raise a really good point. Should not the car business be run by car people? And what the MBAs and finance guys will tell you is, no. It's the finance guys and the MBA types that should run it. I don't buy that anymore.
You think you have to have a good CFO who's good with the numbers? But and Peter's harped on this since day one, is it's all about the product, And trust me, I'm essentially married to a CPA. I mean, we've been together 8 years. But and when it comes to numbers, oh, boy. Do I get that sometimes? But when you're selling something to people, they gotta like it, and you can only CFO or accounting people are gonna be like, how can we kill more cost? How can we kill more cost? They look at it from the bottom up, and really it's a top down thing. You gotta have good product.
Yeah.
The car is the reason you're making money. It's not manipulation of numbers.
Right.
Toyota and Honda are having issues now, but you can't question the fact that they've had 30 years of really doing well, and they still have a lot going for them. And if they weren't run by engineers, they've had a lot of them up in the top tiers of management.
BMW, Mercedes, Porsche. Porsche got into trouble when it got an MBA in time.
Exactly.
Well, but BMW, that's when the wheels came off the car.
I think BMW over, you know, for, up in, we've talked about how they may have some issues, you know, on the show last week, but under Panka, they did very well. Mm-hmm. Their products were terrific, and they really got a lot of momentum. He's a physicist who loves cars. I think he's a nuclear physicist. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Piëch is, you know, insane in some
guy.
Ways, but
he's a car guy.
He's groomed Winterkorn, who's a metallurgist, and he's a car guy. And Volkswagen, I think, is doing some very good things right now, and they're poised to do even better. I'm impressed with them. So we're common thread here is, you know, you have engineers, car guys up at the top tiers of the company.
There's supposedly a great old line of Henry Ford the First, when somebody was saying, well, Henry, you know, don't you think you need like a finance guy, you know, to run the company? Or don't you think you need to learn about finance? And he said, hell no. He says, I'll just hire some son of a bitch who knows that stuff. And quote unquote. And that's what I think you need is great finance people, great business people. But when it comes to this business is about building and selling great cars. And if you do that, everything else is golden.
Go back to GM's heyday, which pretty much is the late 50s to the late 70s. And they had brilliant products, brilliant designers, product people. They had brilliant salespeople. And the finance role, they were just like, make it all happen, you know, keep it all together. And that was the heyday of the company. But after that, this financial collar, you know, grew tighter around the company.
Let's face it, a lot of good finance guys, the good bankers, the ones who didn't get in trouble with mortgage and all of that, are risk averse. And if you're in a business where you're making creative products, being risk averse can be really bad because you're always going to cut costs and do what's safe. And when you do what's safe in a highly competitive consumer business, a fashion business like this one, you know, you're never going to come up with...
You hit a key right there. This is a fashion business.
Well, Harley Earl understood that.
He did.
Bill Mitchell understood that.
He did.
And Ed Welburn
understood that. Right.
And
he brought in Earl.
And Ed Welburn
understands that. But they're design guys. They've got to understand that, or they better not be in the design business. But I got to tell you, it took me most of my career to admit, you know, it really is a fashion business. It really is. You know, I'm thinking all, you know, the business mechanisms and the technical aspect. And no, it is about two things, fashion and instant gratification. And if you understand that, you can do well in the automotive business.
And for people who really like cars, and even for people who aren't crazy about cars, there's something about their image. You know, even the guy who doesn't really like cars but buys a Camry wants people to think he's made a smart purchase. I know you can tell you that people are going to be upset. Oh, our Camry people love their cars. I'm sure they do, but they're not. You know, they're not car people, I'm sorry.
It's an appliance.
it's a great appliance.
And I'm glad you brought up Camry, because we got to talk about Toyota. I mean, this is unreal what's been going on there,
really,
David.
Is.
How did they get into so much trouble? How did they let this happen?
Well, you know, I've written a few stories about this, and not just over this recall. I'm talking going back about 2 years now. This is the biggest, most high-profile, ugly recall they've had, but they've had a lot of recalls. They had the engine sludge issue going back
in the last 10 years.
Engines. Yeah.
Right. They have had the truck plant down in San Antonio.
Yeah, they've had the rusted frames on their pickup trucks. They had actually a couple of pretty sizable recalls on Tundra.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been happening for a while. And
the difference is the media always, when GM or Ford or Chrysler had a recall, it was like top of line in the news for days. And Chrysler had a recall, Toyota had a recall, it'd be like, oh, Toyota recall, and then you'd never hear about it again.
Right.
All of a sudden, this is the only game in town.
That's been, you know, the volume on coverage of Toyota's recalls has been getting bigger over the past few years. Okay, I think it's fairly simple. And they have as much as admitted this, that they expanded really fast over this decade, building plants, new platforms, new vehicles, with a lot of new staff, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, people who weren't groomed in the Toyota way of doing things.
They took their eye off the ball.
Yeah, they moved too quickly. Look, this was in 06 or 07 that Watanabe, the former CEO, bowed deeply in apology before media in Japan and said, we're going to launch an initiative and we're going to fix all of this stuff. And that was, I believe it was 3 years ago. And
I think it was 08.
It was 06 or 07 because I just did something on our blog about it, and I looked it up, and our guy in Tokyo covered the story. It was either 06 or 07. I'm pretty sure it was 07. But so we're looking at 2.5-3 years ago, and they were supposed to get this stuff fixed, and obviously they didn't. And that's when stuff like this happens. I mean, what it looks like we're talking about right now is these accelerator pedals that came from Denso are okay, but the ones from this company CTS are not. And they have, you know, some kind of different material on it when things get humid down there, and you know, you have issues. So that's when things like this slip through the cracks, when engineers are working on, you know, so many things on such hot deadlines, and you know, they can't get it all done.
So, Peter, one of the rumors going around is, will Akio Toyoda
be forced out?
Have to step down,
even
commit
though
seppuku.
Yeah, even though he sort of inherited the whole deal.
Right, not his fault, really.
But do the honorable thing and take a bullet for the team.
Right.
Well, you know, I've had a lot of readers writing, "Oh, this is going to blow over for Toyota," I don't believe that at all. This is different. You know, when Brian Williams leads NBC Nightly News with 5 minutes on this issue, Toyota, the brand, has been tainted. And in this furious internet frenzy we live in these days, this is blown up, or as John Candy said, it blowed up real good to the point where this is going to be a serious issue for Toyota. They've got a tainted brand now. And how are they going to? Everyone says, well, they'll get over it. They'll fix it if they fix it quick. And they, well, you were saying earlier, what do they have to do? They have to fix it quick.
Well, I said I think they can put it behind them. In 2 months now, we might look back and go, those guys were geniuses. Boy, did they handle it right. But I said there's two big ifs. That means if they fix it and it's fixed forever and never ever happens again, and it happens very quickly in the next week and everything goes back to normal, and if there's not another recall.
Not even for anything. Cup holder.
A cup holder. A dome light.
And there's going to be. I mean,
and there's going to be.
Because it happens to everybody, even you know, small stuff.
And the issue that I see, though, is they haven't done anything to get out in front of the story either. They've been hiding in the background and just letting it happen. And especially, and like you're saying, Peter, in this day and age, Twitter and instantaneous everything, you got to be out there at least, I'm not saying deny it, but at least start spinning it.
Well, I think one of the reasons is this has never been in their playbook.
Yeah.
How do you do a massive recall and tell all the media, you know, they've never run this play before?
They were the ones who have already fingered CTS, right?
Yeah.
And CTS said, look, we built these pedal assemblies to their specifications.
Sure.
This is Ford Firestone all over again. The two of them started pointing fingers, and the plaintiff's attorney said, wow, I don't even have to do any investigating during discovery because these guys are laying it all on the table for me. And you know what? I don't care who pays. In fact, I hope both of you do. It's such bad strategy to sit there in public.
Somebody was interviewing me, and they said, you know, well, you know, these things are, first they thought it was made in the United States. They're physically made in Canada. Big difference, but they were saying, doesn't this cast aspersions on American quality? And I'm like, no, this was designed and engineered in Japan.
I was asked
this
that
was,
question on a
this
radio
was built
show today.
To Toyota specifications. Toyota had to validate this. They had to take them in the field and test all this stuff. So I don't blame the supplier unless Toyota can prove that the supplier in a cost cutting move or some other screw up slipped something in there or didn't slip something in there. Then it's different. But the chances are, this is not the supplier's fault.
This is like, you know, when in, you know, dirty secret in the media business, you know, you blame your editor when there's a story that somebody hated. And sometimes it's true, you know, they change something or they wouldn't change something, and you just can't win the argument. They run it and you go, I'm thinking, boy, am I going to hear about this tomorrow. But in fact, you know, it usually is the case, but the person on the other end of that story doesn't care. What they say is, well, so when I deal with you, it doesn't matter what understanding you and I come to in the course of an interview. Something is still going to come up because of your editor, and the end result's going to be bad. The consumer's going to say, I don't care. It may be the supplier, but you spec the part, you put it on the vehicle, and still sold it to me with a warranty. You know, maybe their fault. That's inside baseball to the people whose accelerator pedals have a malfunction.
Up until now, Toyota has had absolutely bulletproof reputation. They skated through the rotting out spare tire carriers falling out of the pickups. They skated through the oil sludge, except for on the internet and the chat rooms. they aren't going to skate through this. I mean, USA Today, you know, had six, I mean, it wasn't six pages, but it was at least three. And all these media outlets have page after page of what's Toyota going to do. And, you know, and in this instant gratification media world we live in, all people equate now is Toyota bad. It used to be Toyota, oh, yeah, they're good. Now it's there's that little thing in there, and I'm telling you, this is not going to blow over. We might be witnessing the end of Toyota's run in this country as the be-all and end-all car company.
And that's saying something from the guy who wrote the book,
yeah.
The United States of Toyota.
Do we see some of the people, New York Times and such, that were like Toyota's almighty and you know, Detroit can't do anything right? Are we going to find their mea culpas for something like this?
Oh, we won't see
it. NotGonnaHappen.com, is that where we're
going to
see it?
Yeah, NotGonnaHappen.com.
The Times did write the story today about how the recall has gone to China and Europe.
Yep.
Yes. But, Peter, you did the boogaloo on Thomas Friedman's face,
well,
too.
Well, now, this is the guy who, in a series of editorials, absolutely...
pilloried General Motors.
General Motors and Detroit, saying this country would be much better off if the domestic automobile industry just went away and Toyota became America's car company because they can do no wrong. They are greener than thou. It's just amazing. You know, the stuff he wrote was just criminal. And now it's just like, okay, Tom, where's the editorial now?
Right.
Basically, you
right.
jackass.
I agree completely.
You know, stick to the Middle East. That's all you know.
Yeah, right.
Do not venture to the car business. You know nothing about it. Not even a whiff of a clue. You know, but this guy, you know, and I was the only one who called him on it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember writing it. You know, this guy got away with murder.
I should show you.
Yeah, you did too.
I did one in Ward's, a column that was titled, Tom Friedman Thinks You're Stupid.
Yeah. And so that era is over with. You know, so we'll see. But believe me, he won't write a word about this.
Oh, no, no, no.
All of a sudden, I don't write
because,
about carpets.
Oh, yeah, because he could be in the same position Toyota's in. All of a sudden, if you start saying, Tom, you wrote this, this, and this, and it's all wrong, well, what does that mean about the other stuff that you wrote, too?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah.
The question is, how much damage is there going to be to Toyota? I think with the baby boomers who've bought their cars for 20 years, it's two decades or so of goodwill built up. They'll be okay with it. Where Toyota's exposed, and see, I don't think they're going to lose a ton of owners over this. What I think they're going to do is lose some of the consideration they had with younger buyers who think Toyota makes really good cars and may still think that they make good cars after this, but now they have a reason to look elsewhere. And it's sort of the continued gain of market share that I think will be severely undercut by this, because now younger people think Toyota's good and think Honda's good and maybe think Ford or Chevy or whatever is good. They're going to look at those other brands more seriously because Toyota has given them a reason.
But we haven't
seen
the whole thing.
There's a gap that others can race through.
Look at the ripple effect that's happening right now. Dealers are taking it on the chin. Suppliers are taking it on the chin.
Rental car companies are pulling them off. Auctions, automotive auctions are pulling them out of the auction.
See, and as you and I were talking about earlier, once you stop selling at auction, your residual values start going down by the minute.
I believe Hertz has a lot of Toyotas in their fleet. I think it's Hertz. But whatever company does, and I know Dower Thrifty grounded their Toyotas. So if you're one of these people reserved a car, and then you fly into town, and they don't have one, or they don't have what you want, because they grounded, you know, a quarter of their fleet or a third of their fleet or whatever they happen to have in that airport.
Either that or
you're on. And the guy at the counter says, well, you know, we got a bunch of Toyotas that we can't rent out because of this thing. You're sitting there. I mean, nothing's worse.
I think it's National that has the Toyotas.
You might be right, but I think Hertz might too. But, you know, whoever it is, yeah. I mean, you're flying in and this happens. And, you know, you're not happy about it. And then all the people in the next, you know, couple of months who are going to go, you know, however long it takes Toyota to get the cars in the dealerships fixed. And I think it's going to take a while. Because what do they have to fix first? Whatever parts they have, they've got to bring the cars in that are owned by people and on the road, and they got to fix those first.
But as you know,
once they're
most
done with
people
that,
ignore recalls. Now, I don't know if they will in this case because it's getting so much attention, but even in the Ford Firestone thing, most people ignored that recall.
That's the dirty little secret that most people don't know. Most consumers go, start it up. I'm going to work or wherever.
Then they're going to have to fix the inventory that's on dealer lots.
That's going
to
be expensive.
So it's going to,
they also have to fix the stuff in the plants.
Yeah, so you have this order, you have to do it. It's going to be, they're going to have to move really fast. I don't know how quickly they can pull this off, but it's going to be a while before they're going to be selling these cars.
Well, going back to your rental car thing, if you're a short, wiry guy with glasses and a cigarette holder and you have a 400-pound Samoan attorney with you, you might want to, it might fit with your trip plans to Las Vegas, give me one of those Toyotas. Yeah. I will live dangerously.
But the thing is, there actually haven't been that many accidents of this.
No.
And I don't want to downplay because some of them are alleged to have been fatal accidents caused by this thing.
Correct.
But isn't the real shocker that the government went to Toyota and said, you have to stop selling? That's the headline that hit me, is
right.
The federal government went to Toyota and said, no, you are no longer selling these vehicles until this issue is fixed.
Right.
That was very interesting,
Eric. I agree.
Camry and Corolla, which are they're probably the two biggest unit.
They are. Two highest volume cars. Because
650,000 sales last year alone to Camry and Corolla.
Just in the U.S., right.
Yeah.
But, no, that's a good point because everyone's been saying, Toyota's doing the right thing. They're putting, people in front of profits. Yada. No, to your point, Ray LaHood, the transportation secretary, told him.
He's not exactly the brightest bulb in the box.
He may not be, but all I'm saying is learning was DOT who told him, you better stop building them and you better stop selling them.
But I got to tell you, this image wreckage is going to really last for
the timing is bad because GM is, we'll see what their fourth quarter earnings look like, but GM is starting to get their feet under them. Right. Ford and Hyundai have momentum, and Volkswagen is laying down an investment for the U.S. market like they've never done before.
Right.
And
short-term, Ford, Hyundai are going to, and GM to a lesser extent, are just going to, look at what Ford and GM are doing.
I think Honda has lost their mojo completely. But I think they are going to be a big beneficiary from this.
Right. Yeah, they'll be an alternative.
Some people aren't going to buy, aren't going to consider U.S. anyways. They'll just go from Toyota over to Honda.
Yeah, the top cross shop with Toyota is a Honda.
The two big gainers, I think, though, are going to be Ford and Honda.
Yeah.
Hey, we got to take a short break here and talk about our sponsor, Dow Automotive Systems, and you can go learn more about them at their website, DowBetaMate.com. And one thing that I'd especially like to talk about, we were at the Washington Auto Show 2 days ago, webcasting live, and we had a guy, Steve Mikowski from Dow Automotive Systems, on there talking about their diesel particulate filter, which we've discussed here before. But the amazing thing is he's saying there's potential rules coming to have particulate filters on gasoline engines, direct injection gasoline engines. And so Dow is looking at, they might be selling this diesel particulate filter, let's just call it a particulate filter, now might be going on gasoline engines. And we might only be 3-4 years away from something like that happening. And that floored me. I had not heard that at all.
I had not heard that either.
So the thing that came out of the beer-making process?
Yeah, right. The beer filtration.
If you just drink more beer,
everything will
better.
Be good. So you might want to check out that interview that we did with Steve Mikowski. It's on the John's Journal section of our website at AutolineDetroit.tv. But very interesting to me how particulate filters may be coming for gasoline engines, direct injection gasoline engines.
So is the diesel exhaust cold filtered?
Chrysling. Okay, that's one I haven't heard from.
So Ford, what do you make of Ford's numbers, Peter? They laid down some impressive numbers.
I don't know how many different ways you can say momentum for a car company, but they definitely have it. They got a lot of hurdles to go. They got a lot of problems to deal with. They've got some financial issues to deal with in 2010. But, boy, they are on a roll, both product. They've got the best leadership. They've got Mullally's got everyone focused. They've got to deal with some heavy-duty financial issues in this year. But, boy, they've got the big mo going.
Well, they do have a lot of debt, but when you're profitable and you generate cash—
Their cash went up $12 billion last year.
And the thing is, you know, in the car business, and you guys know this, when you're running your plants at high utilization levels and you're getting good pricing and you're not discounting the hell out of them, you mint money in this business.
Yes, you do.
Well, and if they're making money in this kind of market,
watch out. Right.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say minting money, but if you look at what their margins are, it was just under 3%. I mean, 3% of a lot of money is a lot of money, but that's a pretty,
you're right.
That's a very, very tight margin.
You're right. But here's what jumped out at me about everything. Last year, Ford sales globally dropped by 590,000 vehicles, almost 600,000 vehicles, their sales dropped. The revenue dropped by $20 billion. And yet on the bottom line, they saw a $17 billion improvement. Now, that is impressive in my book. When your sales crash, your revenue goes way down, and yet you turn your bottom line around. That is impressive.
Let's go back to the good old days, 98, 99, 2000, when all the Detroit companies were making good money. Ford was always more, had better cash flow and more profitable than GM. Because fewer retirees, but also, you know, they were big in trucks. The F-150 makes a lot of money.
More importantly, they were getting more. People were paying more for their vehicles. Their revenue per vehicle was higher. I'm not talking profit per vehicle. I'm talking revenue per vehicle.
Couldn't push out enough Explorers and Expeditions at that point.
But I'm talking on a global basis.
But this is the company that had like $36 billion in cash, which, you know, Nasser and, frankly, the Ford family's...
Ford family took the company by the ankles, shook it upside down, and
took
all
the
cash.
They blew the money. Well, Nasser blew it on a lot of acquisitions and things, too. But the company, when it's managed right, has always been set up to make a lot of money. And now they've done another round of cutting, obviously, over the past decade. And they're making money in a pretty, what is still a bad market. And people say, oh, things are looking up. It's going to be 10, 5, 11 million cars this year. I'm like, look, that's still a terrible market.
But if you're set to make money at 10, 5.
That's what John and I
And you can still keep that. I mean, when things tick up, you don't start. I mean, they need to add some people because, I mean, they didn't get down to the marrow, but they're banging the bone pretty hard in some of their areas. You know, that it does look good other than, as everyone said, $35 billion still out sitting out there in debt.
Yeah, well, you know, John, you've talked about this. You know, if Marchionne, for instance, for Chrysler says, well, you know, we can make money at X amount. And like he said, well, if it turns around, Chrysler has a good chance to make a lot of money, except
they have to sell a million cars in the U.S.
Yeah, the difference is Ford has products and Chrysler doesn't.
Right.
Well, yeah, Chrysler has some good products. By the way, I singled out.
They do?
A few.
Right now?
I singled out the new...
The Ram's a good
product. Ram's a good
product. Ram, the new...
The minivans are still good.
Yeah, and the new Grand Cherokee that's coming is great.
Right.
I singled out the new Dodge campaign that Wieden Kennedy did on the Charger. One in particular called Man Bag, which is really an example of excellent copywriting. And
is that the one with the briefcase that goes, or is this?
No, it's Michael C. Hall does the voice. It's really good, simple. Mm-hmm. It's a long shot of a Charger, and the camera just walks in, and the voiceover.
This isn't the same ad agency that did the I Am Ram.
No.
Commercial.
No, this is
because all the brands have different agencies.
Wieden and Kennedy is the agency that GM should have hired.
This is the ad?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's almost good that they don't have product because now they've got to get down to the brass tacks of how do you market and sell. And that'll be a great litmus test for Marchionne to find out who can get the job done. Who can move the metal when we don't have that new a product?
Are we getting any audio?
No, he kept it down so we could talk.
Oh, okay, because the audio is really good. I mean, the spot's really well written.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Ford for a second. And everyone's been asking this question. Mullally sort of half-answered that when you had him on Tuesday?
Tuesday.
Right. What they're going to do with Mercury. And he says, well, it's going to sort of be this mid-tiered, small, and I'm trying to figure out what product is he going to fill that in that isn't, you know, a redone interior and a rebadged Ford, unless they're bringing something over from Europe. But There's not that we're coming to the point. There's not going to be that much difference between product in Europe and product here that he can fill mercury in.
I don't think Ford's going to be worrying about mercury much.
Yeah,
it's going to be Ford and Lincoln. By the way, I had a Raptor. You had the Raptor.
Yeah.
I had the Raptor this week.
What a monster.
What a monster. What
it is so cool.
It is
I would never buy one in a million years.
No.
But, man, I love to get to test drive these things because that was a riot to have.
It's like indescribable what that thing is about. I mean, you say, oh, yeah, it's just another truck. No.
No, it's not.
It's not another truck.
I
that thing
conversation
is.
Station with some people. They told me they were all on the West Coast right now. I'm like,
That's awesome.
I could believe it.
The hood?
Well, they're going to put the bigger motor in it this spring. It's got, you know,
got a 5.4 in it right now,
yeah,
but they're waiting for the 6.2.
Yeah, the 6.2. But it's just an
awesome. Do you remember the F-150 Lightning?
Yeah.
Yeah, but see, this is.
That was SVT. That was super.
But that was set up with the lowered suspension
That's what was cool about it. It was like driving a car. I mean, it was.
But the Raptor doesn't make any pretense. It's Raptor is the thing that you can drive over those parking lot bumpers at 100 miles an hour and not even feel them.
Should do it at that speed.
The question at the auto show I heard from a number of people who were waiting for the Ford reveal of the Focus was, can they sell the 8,000 they have to sell for 4 years of that? I mean, it's a neat truck, but are there enough people in the southwest of you know, Texas, Arizona?
What, to get a Raptor?
Yeah. Can they sell 8,000? I mean, isn't that what they're scheduled to do, 8,000 units for 4 years?
Maybe. But and let's say they don't. Let's say they only sell 6,000 or 7,000. I don't know the business plan.
Good, but.
But Ford's doing a brilliant job of extending their model line. We had Jim Farley on during the auto show, Detroit Auto Show, and he talked about this. No more El Stripo models. Gone. Das ist verboten. And they'll have is very competitively priced, very nicely equipped, you know, mass market models. But then they'll do the Platinum Edition of the F-150. They'll do the
King Ranch.
The King Ranch version. They'll do the Raptor. They'll do the SHO for the Taurus. You know, they're always going to have these stretch models. And what it does is it gives a halo to the brand, and they make a lot of money on each one. And the dealers love the stuff, and the salespeople like it even more because they make great commissions on it.
Think we can hear can we hear the audio of that spot? It's only 25
Ben,
seconds.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. We'll just listen to Michael C. Hall from Dexter. Ever seen Dexter?
Oh, yeah.
Listen to this. This is good.
What is that thing? Well, I'll tell you what it isn't. It isn't a man bag. It isn't man sandals. It isn't a locale plate. It isn't a yoga class. It isn't an exfoliant with added moisturizer. It isn't a couple's cooking class. And it certainly isn't a small dog that needs to wear a jacket if the temperature drops below 70. That's what it isn't.
That's it.
That I had not heard. I had not heard that. That is well written.
Absolutely. Spot on. Very good.
And the voiceover is good. That guy who's talking in the I Am Ram commercials, he sounds like a guy who would play the sex offender in an episode of CSI. You know, he's got this really smarmy, creepy. I hate that ad more than any ad I've seen in the history of advertising.
That's actually Stan Richards.
Really? Oh, God, it sounds
cool. The Richards Group in Dallas. I don't know how old he is, but that forget about that. People think I'm out to Barry Chrysler's, and
I'm not either.
All I can say to them is blank you till the hell freezes over. But that's a good spot, and I'm saying it, so you can trash me if you want, but I really don't give a shit.
I like it because it's no excuses. This is what it's going to be. You don't like it, we don't care.
I mean, people don't buy a Charger because, you know, they're worried about fuel economy, really. I mean, yeah, it'll get
the economy,
25 or 30, whatever it gets.
It's good enough.
It's good enough. You just want a badass car, get it, you know?
Right.
Quit the hand wringing.
Hey, you guys know what time it is. It's time for
Rapid Fire.
Rapid Fire. Bring up the graphic, and Chip's got the question. Okay, Sean Walsh from Woodbridge, Virginia wants to know, how did the electric vehicle section at the DC show compare to Electric Avenue in Detroit? Well, the DC show, number one, is just cars on a carpet. It's a regional dealer show, and nobody would pay it any attention except for all these big politicos come swinging through the show, and that was worth being there. So Electric Avenue at Detroit, much better. But I did learn some things at the Washington, D.C. show. There's a company I got to learn more about called Bright. Have you guys heard this Bright EV? It's run by a guy. He's the guy who was heavily involved in the GM EV1 program. They're down in Anderson, Indiana. I'm walking around, and, you know, most of these electric cars look like student projects, high school student projects. Mm-hmm. And then I come to this van, and I look at it, and I go, oh, my God, this thing's beautifully built, well turned out, inside out and backwards. Turns out to be these Bright guys. So to answer your question.
But I haven't seen the car.
We got to learn more. These guys know what they're doing. Okay, Jason Jadis. He's had me butcher his name enough that he sent in the phonetic pronunciation. Jadis. If Chrysler is struggling miserably and it has a car that is selling well, such as the Challenger, why do we not see it featured in commercials? Mr. Advertising Expert, Peter?
Good question. I really don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I'd like to get into the brains out there, but as soon as my car gets within 15 miles of the place, it goes dead. So I'm not welcome, but that's a good question. But I think, you know, I think they have problems with the Challenger. You know, when you start looking at the 2011 Mustang coming and you look at the Camaro, Challenger isn't looking
so good. The Synergy Green Edition Camaro.
Yeah. Challenger isn't looking so good. And when you see them on the road, if you're ever on the road and you see a Camaro and a Challenger within a couple of lanes of each other, Challenger isn't looking so good. It's tall. It's like a phone booth. So they got some issues there. Good question. I don't have the answer for it.
Dirk Clary from Los Angeles wants to know.
Dirk. He's a reader.
Oh, is he? Good. Cool. Can Cadillac realistically compete with Mercedes, BMW, and Audi in the U.S. without a serious sales and distribution strategy in Europe? I like this question. After all, part of the appeal of the German cars with U.S. buyers is the perception they're the best luxury cars worldwide.
I think they can compete with them in the U.S. I mean, I think they are.
CTS-V is the finest high-performance sedan in the world.
He does make a good point, though, that especially, we've talked on this show about Cadillac going back to the standard of the world, but they do some sales in China and I think the Middle East and, of course, here, but they're nowhere in Europe. Yeah. They have started, stopped a million times in Europe with Cadillac. Yeah. You remember, they did Le Mans in 2000 or 2001, I think 2000?
A couple of years.
2000, 2001. Yeah,
2000 was the first year they came back, and they didn't have any products over there.
And then they rolled out the BLS they had out there?
Yeah, right.
That didn't do them any favors over there. I mean, that was wild.
But they haven't had real distribution in Europe. They didn't give it any real marketing. The products were sort of like Cadillac's strategy in Europe, other than BLS, was basically taking cars engineered for American highways and American driving habits and gas prices and heaving them over the
Atlantic. But the biggest problem you guys are missing, 70% of all European luxury sales are diesel. Yeah. And they didn't put a good diesel. They had that, you know, what was it, some diesel in the BLS.
That super diesel that they shelved.
Yeah.
That super diesel, which was probably one of the best engines to come out of Detroit in years.
They're not serious about going to Europe. And when you ask, I asked that question of Nick Riley at the auto show, and there's no plans to.
But for the U.S., I don't think it really matters.
I don't think it does either.
I think it's important, but I think you can have good sales in the U.S. without it. But if you realistically compete, is what he said.
Before Lincoln and Cadillac screwed up, they were fighting for the lead in the market over the imports, and they weren't selling anything in the 90s over there.
Yeah. Okay, we're running out of time here. Jay Cujo says, question for Peter. Is it a mistake for GM and Ford to advertise for Toyota owners? Toyota didn't go after them when they were doing their bankruptcy dances.
They're not advertising. I think, you know, at this point, after Toyota's eaten GM and Ford's lunch for 20 years, I think they're entitled to a little bit of, it's war, boys, and we're coming after you. I think they're entitled to do it.
There's some payback to be had here. I mean, Toyota's had, I'm using this term very loosely, and it's a little sarcastic, so no hate mail, but they've literally had half of the automotive press in their back pocket writing their copy for them for how long. Detroit can get a little back right now and not sweat it too much.
Okay, Jim Schultz from Sioux Falls, South Dakota wants to know, is it possible to purchase stock in Eco Motors? Eco Motors, of course, being the company that Don Runkle's working with now. I don't think so. I don't think they're public. They're all being financed. Don rattled off a couple of the firms.
You could maybe call Don and try to invest some cash and see.
Yeah.
Watch for that IPO.
Yeah, right. There's some private equity behind them right now. I think they're going after some government money to further develop the engine. But I want to keep an eye on that.
Start a car company and go after some government money.
That is a great idea. Then we can go to Bermuda.
We call it Edison.
Or
since there's Tesla, you can call it Edison.
No, we'll call it Renzo Motors.
There you go.
Fuking.
Renzo Motors, and then we have
formerly of Fuking Motors.
Right. And then we all move to a country with no extradition treaty with the United States.
And no speed limits.
Venezuela?
Andy S. from Plymouth, Michigan, says, you mentioned VW will significantly increase its market share in the U.S. My question is, who's going to buy those vehicles? Yeah, VW looks good and drives great, but based on my 99 Jetta my wife owned, they are overpriced pieces of junk.
Well, he brings up two separate issues, though. First one is quality, which is still a problem. Now, they've gotten better. You watch them, they're about middle of the pack in the J.D. Power surveys now if you buy into those. So quality is improving at Volkswagen, but they've still got the image to deal with. The price one they're going to lick, because that midsize car that they're going to sell in the U.S., it's going to be built in Chattanooga, it's going to price at $20,000. That's the target anyway. But
that's the Fusion Camry competitor.
Yeah, it's going to be competitively priced with Fusion Camry, Accord, Malibu. So that's going to be looked. And they're going to be building basically the Jetta replacement in Puebla, Mexico. And it's the same thing. It's not going to be engineered for Europe. It's going to be engineered for North America. It will be competitively priced. So they're going to lick that one. And look, they sold in a real market 100,000 overpriced, undersized, lousy quality Jettas a year. 100,000 is pretty good numbers for a car with those kind of handicaps.
But they have some very wildly optimistic / aggressive sales targets for this market, and I wish them the best. But really?
The issue, if they're going to start selling a lot of vehicles, they've got to fix their dealer experience. Everyone I know with a VW hates the dealer network, and that's something that's got to be fixed ASAP.
That's a great point. And Andy, you raise a great question, because I think if Volkswagen's going to hit these wildly optimistic sales figures they're shooting for, their quality's not up to snuff. It just isn't. They got to get that straightened out.
The TDI Sportwagon has got to be, if you want a manual transmission diesel wagon, that's the car. And trust me, it is a phenomenal car.
It's sweet. I agree. You know, things gone wrong, Volkswagen isn't very good. Things gone right, they pegged the needle. Okay, EAB says, everyone I talk to agrees with me that the front part of the Taurus console really crowded the front passengers. Did any of you notice this?
Yeah, I've got one out in the parking lot right now. I have an SHO out there right now.
And do you agree with them, the console's in the way?
It's a little crowded. My issue is more that the material they used on the side, it's hard plastic. Mm-hmm. Everything else in there is soft touch. And right. When your knee is banging it, but it's resting against it.
Robin.
My issue with most interiors, $10 more of material to make $1,000 worth of price, well, $200 worth of materials. But it's a little tight in there, I think. But
Pedro Fernandez asks, do you foresee the U.S. imposing tariffs on Chinese cars if they come in at very low prices and start harming the domestic brands?
I don't know. Boy, these two countries are dancing around these little trade skirmishes, and I don't.
Peter, was it last week that you said that China owns all of our debt, but if we decide to really screw with them, we can kill our imports of them, and that basically starts a revolution? Was that somebody else who
said that? I didn't say that.
Because there's so many people from the north who've moved to the south for work, and that if the U.S. cuts off what we buy from China, that literally completely wrecks their economy. So it was sort of.
We're not going to do that.
I mean, we're never going to do that, what I'm saying.
Even if it was a good idea, we have never had the guts to really even impose fair trade agreements, let alone use it as retribution.
We can't even have fair trade agreements with Japan.
No. So the last time we had that was what, the mid '80s
our government still has plans to fight wars all over the place, be the world's cop, you know, reform health care and create jobs, do all these things. They're going to require us to keep floating debt in the Asian countries, whether, you know, the Japanese, the Chinese, occasionally the Koreans buy a lot of those bonds.
I mean, every other country operates as a corporation, Japan Inc., Germany Inc., you know, we don't. And that's an issue.
Yeah, we got to figure, and there's a lot to be done. You know, it's not like you can do this little thing or that little thing. It's a comprehensive policy.
As my mom used to say, it's not, shouldn't call him Uncle Sam. You should call him Uncle Sap.
Yeah.
But no, the two parties hate each other so much right now that I really believe we've lost the ability to govern ourselves. James Baker even wrote that in Time about a year and a half ago, and he's even more right now than he...
No, something's got to change.
If we had a real industrial policy, a real energy policy, that could be scary how good we could be, but it's, you know, not going to happen.
That's a good point. We could be scary good.
Promote auto line.
Yes.
Promote energy policy, promote
auto line
Detroit.
Oh, yeah. This Sunday on Auto Line Detroit, we've got three people in talking all about energy policy and industrial policy, well, especially energy policy.
We've needed a minimum price for fuel that gradually goes up for so long now.
Right.
We need to get smart in this country, and boy.
Okay, John Wills asked, what do you think of the NADA's conflict with GM and Chrysler? I heard Roger Penske admit his dealer network needs to be reduced further in the next 2 years. NADA claims GM and/or Chrysler may be placing new franchises in regions where they recently closed down poor-performing dealers in order to block the reopening of wound-down dealers. This is a—I mean, he's asking a whole mouthful here, but
the dealer thing is such a mess.
It's also ridiculous, I think. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean— I know there are franchise agreements, and I know there are families that have run these things, and people work there. You know, I don't want to see anyone lose their jobs, their livelihood, but, you know, if you open up a chicken shack someplace and it doesn't go well, nobody comes and bails you out. You board up the windows, sell the fryer later, and move on with your life. I mean,
how many of these?
why do we have to bail these guys out, or why do the companies have to bail them out or give them something?
Yeah. How many of these dealers complain to their congressmen who were the same congressmen who were piling on of, like, just shut everything down? I'm kind of curious of, as everyone said, it's like when it starts hitting all politics is local. Politics got very local, and all of a sudden, you know.
But here's the thing I say. GM paid the dealers that got closed down.
Yep.
Chrysler did not. They just yanked their franchises, and they said, tough. And to me, that's unfair. You got to compensate those guys. Should they be let back in? No, probably not. But you should compensate them. That's my take. You just can't take somebody's business away from them and say, tough. And I agree, if you went out of business, that's one thing. But this was the government telling Chrysler, go shut down dealers. And they did. And Chrysler thought it had cover from the White House to go do this under bankruptcy.
And the White House said, well, you're on your own.
Well, Congress got involved.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I think that the Chrysler dealers got screwed. Anyway, Jim Schultz asks, John, could you refresh my memory about what makes an A-class car, a B-class car, et cetera?
Size. It's interior size? Or is it the length?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know exactly.
Is it footprint?
It could be the footprint, axle and track, you know, wheelbase and track. But A-class is really small. Like a smart car is an A-class car. A B-class car would be like a Ford Fiesta,
Jazz.
The new Ford Fiesta, yeah. The Honda Fit or Jazz,
yeah,
right?
Sorry. Too much Top Gear.
C-class would be like
the new Focus.
Civic.
CD is going to be like Fusion. D would be a full-size car like a Taurus. And
Is Chrysler 300 bigger than D? I guess it would be an E-class.
I'd say it's a D. It's a D-class car, Chrysler 300, is what I would say. And I don't know. Does it go beyond D?
Sure.
Is there
what's
an E?
What's a Maybach? Q?
I think I've heard someone say it an E-class car, which would probably be an E-class. Would probably be an E-class car.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here.
Thank you.
Well, that's why Mercedes went A. They got the A-class. They got the B-class. B-series.
Okay, do you guys consider the Genesis Coupe? Do you guys consider the Genesis Coupe a pony car? And if so, is it successful?
No, it's not a pony.
It's not a pony car.
No, it's a pretty cool car, but
it's a nice little almost sports car that looks exactly like a 370Z. But yeah,
it's not a pony car.
Not a pony car. Is it successful? I don't know. I don't know the sales of the coupe.
Ask Dan Bodoro for some numbers on that.
Right. I could look them up here, but probably don't have time. And let's see. I think that's about it. Anyway, we're almost at the top of the hour, so.
Did we get any phone calls? No.
No phone calls. I don't believe so.
For shame.
And yeah, we'll have to promo that a little bit harder in the future. But
you know, going back to the Dewar thing, I mean, making sure these guys get a buyout, to me, reinforces the precedent that has hamstrung the domestic companies from killing off bad brands for a long time. They're afraid of having to buy out the dealers, so they have no control over their marketing and their brand and product strategy because they're stuck with stuff like Pontiac and, you know, Saturn and things that they couldn't sell because of the dealer issue. I mean, it, you know, why do these guys deserve some big bailout or
well, I'm not saying a bailout. All I'm saying is that it's wrong for the government to order a company to tell its franchisees the deal's over. You're breaking their franchise, which is illegal to do, and yeah, say, we're going to give you the cover of bankruptcy court. We're going to run the cover for you. And what I've said all along is,
supposed to be able to do that in bankruptcy court.
Well,
GM, what Fritz Henderson, when he was still there, told me is that they were doing stuff like trying to find a buyer for Saturn and keep it alive and doing these things for the dealers for goodwill. Mm-hmm. They could have wiped out franchise agreements in bankruptcy. I mean, you can still sue in bankruptcy court, but you're not going to get anything.
Yeah, but then why didn't you wipe out all the bondholders? Why didn't you wipe out the union? Why didn't you
pretty much wipe out the bondholders?
Well, they
didn't wipe out the union. That's a different issue. But you're in bankruptcy. You're I mean, bankruptcy, whether people like to admit this or not, it is breaking a contract.
But the dealers themselves didn't fail. General Motors had to come and yank their franchises, or Chrysler, and GM.
But there are dealers I know who invested, and I won't name this dealer because he's very well known, but a dealer who invested massive amounts of money into Hummer and Saab franchises in a big, big growing market. And we're talking, like, from what I heard, like $20 million, and it was done a couple years ago. I don't have a lot of market intelligence sitting at my desk, but if anyone called me and said, hey, I was thinking of investing $20 million in Hummer and Saab franchises 2 years ago, I'd say, listen, give it to me, and I'm going to start an electric car company.
Is that the same Hummer dealer selling AK-47s?
No.
Or whatever, assault rifles, or whatever they were
selling? By the way, all you Saab people out there who are thrilled that Spiker's taking over Saab, get real.
Get real. I love ain't going to last.
Spikers, to me, are the most beautiful car on the market. From an exterior, the interiors, I absolutely love.
You mean other than a Morgan?
Yeah. but yeah, a car company that made, 260 units last year?
People need to...
They need a reality check. Saab is not going to survive.
They need to make their peace. And
I mean, I think GM's got to be careful with this because, you know, some of these dealer liabilities can end up back in their lap if Spiker can't make this thing work.
Well, that was the issue why they couldn't get the deal done, wasn't it? Is because GM was afraid of it's going to fall apart 2 years, and all of a sudden they're going to be saddled with, you know, contracts and suppliers and all that.
I just don't see Spiker.
I don't know why they're. I frankly don't know why they're selling it. I mean, now it's a $400 or $500 million. It's a $500 million deal is what GM's getting, but I think what $340 million of it is in preferred stock, which isn't going to be worth anything if the company doesn't survive.
Right. No, I mean, GM should only sell it if it can walk 100% away from all future liability. And if it cannot do that, it better shut it down because there's no way Spiker is going to save this thing. No way. So, you know, maybe the name will survive, but the operation in Trollhättan, Sweden, as we know it today, ain't going to make it.
Do you know what? GM doesn't own the Saab name.
Who does? Saab still? Saab truck? Or Saab aircraft?
I think it's sort of jointly held. This was explained to me by one of the Saab spokesmen in Trollhättan. I think it's jointly held by Saab Truck, Scania, and...
Well, Scania is Saab Truck.
But I mean, the investment firm? Is it like Investor AB? The Wohlenbergs, right? Huh. They've got a piece. It's like a three-way holding between these groups. One is Scania, and I forget the other two, but maybe the aircraft company or something, and a third.
The same way GM has to license Hummer from AM General?
Does GM license it from them? Or they own the Hummer name, I thought.
I thought they bought the Hummer name.
I think they did.
Okay.
But the point is, look, you know, Saab sells one half of one assembly plant capacity worldwide. Yeah. And no car company.
Not even that. They sold fewer than 100,000 last year.
Right.
And what, Volvo sold, what, 320,000 last year, I think was in that Ford statement that was released today?
Mm-hmm.
310,000?
Which is still not a very big number.
The only companies that live down in the real low margins are, you know,
Exotic.
Ferrari.
You got to charge a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, Porsche can live very happily at 100,000 a year. Saab cannot. Just ain't going to happen.
Yeah. Low volume, and I mean, the pricing isn't bad, but it's not enough to make that work.
Well, hey, we're at the top of the hour here. Let's wrap it up. You know, I want to thank you guys, of course. Eric, great having you in here. You're always so good at monitoring and streaming this show. It's great to have you in the studio with us.
Great to be here, John. I appreciate you guys having me in. And find me on my site, rumblestrip.net, Twitter, twitter.com/rumblestrip. And project that you can look for me in the beginning of March is I'm doing a video for MS Awareness Week. With the Michigan chapter of the National MS Society. So that'll be something else I'm working on. So.
Cool. Good. That's good. You can always follow Peter at autoextremist.com. You can follow David Welch at businessweek.com.
Right. And Bloomberg.com.
And Bloomberg.com. You can follow us at facebook.com/outofline Detroit. Follow us on Twitter as well. So good. A lot to talk about today.
Lonely but free, I'll be fine.
And folks, when you go into the Winter Garden in the Rensen, just say hi to the guy with the cowboy hat. That's Big Ed. He's the official greeter down there.
Thanks again to Dow Automotive Systems for their support of Autoline After Hours. Visit www.DowBetaMate.com to learn more about how Betamate is reducing vehicle weight and enhancing durability. That's DowBetaMate.com. Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Outerline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more at autolinedetroit.tv.